So this is Bill Nelson, director of the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center, here exploring the new horizons in cancer research. Today we're here with Andrew Ewald. Andy Ewald is a cell biologist who's taking a new look at what cancer is, how it grows, and with an avenue to how we might better diagnose, detect it, and treat it. Now, Andy, for many years, people have taken human cancer cells outside the body, isolated them down to a single cell, and tried to grow them on dishes, sort of petri dishes, if you will. And we've gotten far with that. Many of the cancer drugs that we have were screened against cancer cells in this way. The cells are growing on a dish. The new cancer drugs were put on the cells that would kill some of them, and we try to get them into people. But this clearly belied a huge amount of complexity as to what that cancer cell was doing in its habitat in the body, where it was conspiring to threaten life itself. How is a cancer cell in a dish different from what cancers are doing in the body, and how are you looking at this?
Well, Bill, I think it's great that you started off by acknowledging the success of all these approaches in the petri dish, right? We can't start from saying, what's the most complicated way in which I could possibly study cancer and study everything all at once? So we need to start from the point of view of what's the simplest model that could explain everything. Then I think we want to look at what it stops being able to explain and focus our attention there. So we want to acknowledge that there's been decades of success now in terms of looking at how cancer cells grown in petri dishes affect each other, how they respond to therapy, and what are the key molecular drivers affecting their growth and ability to spread. However, what we have to acknowledge at this point is that the drugs that arose from those approaches, they've been effective for some patients and not for others. And what's really striking now is that patients with metastatic disease, where the cancer is spread through the body, they have improved outcomes compared to 20 years ago, but not nearly as good as we would like them to be. So what we're very interested in understanding is, how do we understand the ways in which a cancer cell in a tumor, especially in a metastatic tumor, responds differently to a cancer cell in a petri dish?
So one of the technologies that you and others are deploying is the ability, rather than to just think about a single cancer cell on a dish, is to start to reconstruct its habitat, if you will, by thinking about what it does to form a tumor in three dimensions. And some people call this organoid cultures. What are organoids?
Organoid is sort of a funny term because different groups around the world all use it. The simplest definition is an organoid in the last few years has been a great way to raise funds, right? So,
and attract attention.
Yeah. So underneath it, there's actually a bunch of different techniques being utilized, right? The common theme across all of them is exactly what you highlighted, to understand the cancer cell in its context. The key thing to understand is that there's different contexts a cancer cell exists in the body, and for a different experiment, for a different scientific question, you might have different aspects you want to focus on. So what we're trying to do, I come from the West Coast style, if you will, of organoid technology, deriving out of UCSF and Lawrence Berkeley Lab, thinking hard about how to understand the cancer cell in its context. What we're trying to do is get a fast, convenient, scalable model system out of something that in the body is slow, complicated, and inaccessible. So we take the tumor out, chop it up with a scalpel, digest it with enzymes, and we get thousands of replicates, thousands of mini tumors that are organ-like, therefore organoids. We're then able to test very many different hypotheses with tissue from the same sample. So with a clinical sample, that is about 3,000 organoids. With a mouse model of breast cancer metastasis, that can be as many as 300,000. So what we're focusing on, and what we focused on in the last 10 years, was the ways in which cell-cell contact, how cells talking to each other directly affected phenotype, cell matrix contact, how the proteins around them affected them, and that soluble signals, the kinds of molecules that the cells throw up in the air, growth factors and cytokines affect them.
Well, one of the things that you've been a pioneer in developing is, as you begin to consider how cancer cells interact with each other and with their environment in these three-dimensional cultures, organoids if you will, is you have to build new ways to examine them, new ways to use the microscope or new types of microscopes that not only see things in three dimensions, inventorying where cells are with respect to each other and what they're doing. Used to be in a cell in a dish, you just watch it crawl or jump across something or traverse something. Now you're looking in three dimensions, but also in three dimensions over time, creating huge amounts of information, needing new optics, new software. This can tell us about how that works. You're really a pioneer in this.
Well, thank you. So the key there is to understand that because the process of metastasis, which is the main focus of my lab, occurs deep inside the body over years to decades in a patient, it's very difficult to directly observe it. Right? It's almost impossible to directly observe it in patients. But we have to have a working model for how it occurs. And so what it's relied on is a lot of inferences. It might work this way, it might work that way, which slowly codified into very specific models for how people thought it worked that didn't have enough data underlying them. Right? So what drove my interest in bringing the imaging together with the organoid technology was to be able to make very direct observations with primary and metastatic site tumor tissue. So we can take a tissue out of a mouse or out of a patient, put it in the lab, and really understand how it works. From the specific point of view of imaging, there was three different scales that we've taken from the last 10 years, and I can also chart out where we're going. So the first was just to figure out, how does the tissue change its structure and function over time? So for that, we wanted to get hundreds of examples over time, where we could take different examples and manipulate the signaling, manipulate the stromal cells that are nearby, manipulate the mechanics, and understand what leads to tumor growth, tumor shrinkage, tumor dispersal to distant sites. The next step was to be able to, and that was microscopes like differential interference contrast, which is a fancy way of saying a really good white light microscope, technology that existed in the 1970s. The next step was to be able to use specific contrast to understand the structure of the cells as they do this. How does the chromatin change? How does the cytoskeleton, so the parts that move the cell, how does the membrane change? And that required fluorescence microscopy, again done in parallel over dozens of examples in 3D over time. The next level was to be able to say, what are the cells thinking? Right? I went from how does the tissue change its structure and function to how do the cells accomplish that change? And then the next question is, how's the cell making decisions? Right? So we were able to take in a paper we published about a month ago, we were able to use fluorescence biosensors, which turn molecular activities into light that we can capture, to look at classic signaling pathways like PI3 kinase, like RAS, right? Like the consequences for the structure of the cell in terms of actin polymerization, and visualize all of these in real time in cells as the tissue is changing shape. What we see is the next horizon is to be able to go in two directions. The first is digital pathology, to bring this understanding of tissue, cell, and molecular activity to clinical samples at scale, right? To be able to scan hundreds of examples with known clinical outcomes and really understand what's correlating. The second area is to bring in, and this is in partnership with Joel Bader, a professor here of biomedical engineering, really brilliant applied mathematician in addition to that, to bring the concepts from population genetics, and specifically quantitative trait loci analysis, so that we can look at these movies and say, okay, among clinical samples, this tumor is invading with this structure, a different one with another structure. Let's very precisely define that mathematically, use Fourier transforms to capture that shape information, and use that shape information to understand which genes are contributing how much to that phenotype. This will enable us to systematically determine the molecular contributions to specific metastatic behaviors without needing to know in advance even whether they're mutations or translocations or gene expression changes. It can simply be systematic.
So here's a question for you. One, you know, historically, when all the way back to Virchow, when pathologists would make diagnoses of cancer, and of course a pathologist looks at tissues through a microscope to make a diagnosis of cancer, what the pathologist would attempt to do is to fix these things, fix these structures in place to prevent the tissues from rotting, decomposing, if you will, and to freeze them in place, and if they were distributed, the cells around an abnormal shape, they could say, look, we fixed them in place, they look in an abnormal shape compared to the normal tissue or what seems to have been an abnormal pattern of growth. But innately, these were all fixed tissues, so you're sacrificing, in a pathologist examination of the tissue, all of these properties over time, what something's moving, where it's going, how it's behaving over time. Can you imagine a time where pathology itself, diagnostic surgical pathology in some routine type way, might be live tissue pathology instead of fixed tissue pathology?
So I can imagine a future that involves that. I want to first start off by saying that one of the things that is so exciting as a basic scientist being at a cancer center like this is the opportunity to interact with world leaders in pathology, oncology, surgery, radiation oncology. And so we can not just envision that future, but we can talk to the pathologists who are building that here now. So in terms of specifically live tissue pathology, yes, we can. We made a, I can specifically imagine being able to identify in live tissue features of a breast tumor, which would predict that patient's individual risk of metastatic recurrence. So be able to take tissue from the patient, put it in the dish, watch how it performs in terms of invasion and specific molecular characteristics of that invasion, and then be able to estimate a patient's risk of recurrence. For reasons of logistics, practicality, and a desire to be able to develop solutions which can be implemented across the country, indeed across the world, in different resource environments, I think practically speaking, the near-term application is live cell pathology as a means to understand which features to monitor in classic pathologic assays, to suggest, in addition to the successful assays they already run, we should monitor this gene and that gene, maybe sum them up. Because I want to be able to have the broadest impact as quickly as possible and to recognize that pathologies have already defined a set of features which are highly accurate for defining patient outcomes and care.
Now, I was curious about that. Don Coffey, who you knew, was here for many years, passed away this year, argued very strongly. He envisioned this type of future as well and argued, at least at some low level, in his exploration of this with the technologies he's had at the time, that you know, if normal tissue cells were viewed over time, they were dancing a waltz, but cancer cells seemed to be dancing a jitterbug. They were clearly different in their behaviors in addition to their appearance. Another question for you in general is one of the challenges for using this for research in particular. Historically, it's been very difficult to steer that much light at a cell for that long without making it upset in some way. How do you get around that?
So that's that was something I actually got to work on a lot as a grad student, as a postdoc. As you know, my bachelor's is actually in physics, and my PhD was in biochemistry and molecular biophysics at Caltech.
This is, for our listeners, this is like sunburning the cells almost quite literally, right?
Yeah, it can actually be very specific what it's doing there. I casually say, hey, look, we image hundreds of movies, right, across all of these different pieces of the tumor, and we can do that for a week or two. Right? That would, the critical technical challenge we had to overcome is exactly what you're saying. Cells do not like really bright, high energy light being shined on them all the time, right? And so what it does is at the quantum physics level, what you're doing is you're exciting the dye, right? It goes into an excited state, and it can, with certain probability, go into this triplet state, which when it decays creates free radical oxygen. The bottom line there from that explanation is that if you're putting light in there all the time, you're creating this high energy free radical oxygen, which goes out and wrecks whatever's nearby, including DNA, including critical signaling molecules. If that level is too high of oxygen, free radical oxygen production, the cells die really very quickly. You can kill cells in seconds with excess light. So conversely, cells do see light. Lots of cells in the body see light regularly. So if you can keep the light level low enough, they actually don't care. It's much like a chemical buffer. If you're below the buffering capacity, the solution's fine. If you're below the antioxidant capacity of the cell, it's fine. So the secret to this, what I learned from Scott Fraser when I was a graduate student doing imaging, is that what you have to be very careful of is the emission light path. Everything from where the light is produced by the dye molecule back to the detector needs to be as absolutely efficient as possible so you can turn the incoming light down as far as possible. And to the extent that the microscopes that I've designed and implemented and purchased have been effective, it's really because of that guiding insight from Scott that you need to optimize the emission sensitivity. The first camera we bought here was actually export controlled. It was an intensified CCD used frequently in military applications. It's next generation night vision technology. And so it had an incredible ability to amplify very rare light signals. What we benefit from now has been a huge increase in the ability of cameras to sensitively and efficiently detect light. And so we actually swapped one out recently. But the key to all of that, too much light equals too much free radical oxygen. So you just got to keep the light level down and you can basically image forever.
So you do a little bit in the twilight rather than in the dark or the bright light. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you were only a physicist, only interested in light and optics and stuff, this would be far less interesting a conversation. But in fact, as a molecular biologist and cell biologist, you're using state-of-the-art technologies to create and interfere with very specific cellular processes, and it's the collision of these two where the exciting new information and new insights are coming from. And so as you build up from first principles, a cell on a dish, learn what you can learn, begin to see what an organoid does with all the tools you have in molecular biology, you're beginning to reconstitute function by function stromal cells, ultimately, I suspect, immune cells, other types of cells, other types of structures. How is this going to play out? Are you going to go after them one by one? Are you going to be able to, like the $6 million man, rebuild the cancer in a dish in ways that you could control and monitor?
So we're really interested in this question of how much of the tumor function can you reconstitute in a simplified assay? And I really like your choice of words, reconstitution, because we're actually quite specifically modeling this on the classic biochemical reconstitution assays, right? If you have this whole complicated cell, it's thousands, tens of thousands of molecules, you want to reconstitute a specific metabolic function, you know you've done it when you can throw away 99.9% of it and reconstitute the function with just a defined set of molecules. So what we're doing is we're taking the tumor, that chopping and digesting, which sounds simple, what it does is it takes the tumor apart, literally molecularly, with those enzymes, into its constituent parts. And we can then select exactly which parts to bring back. Your intuition, no surprise, is quite good. Having spent 10 years working on the epithelial cells, right? How do the epithelial cells of the cancer really determine what's going on? We used some wonderful support from the Cancer Center to build an inventory. How many different cell types could we get out of here? One at a time and in combination, how do they affect function? We're getting some really fun surprises. Again, as you'd expect, with immunotherapy being the most exciting thing in cancer therapy today, we've been very interested in it, quite successful in bringing different innate and adaptive immune cells into these cultures and reconstituting at least basic aspects of immune function there. It's still a goal, and we're working towards to bring in entire logics, right? To bring in a whole suite of different presenting, stimulating, repressing cells. But it seems very realistic on, a 2-year time scale to be able to reconstitute whole functional circuits, if you will, on the stromal side. To this point, the surprising thing has been how much we've been able to reconstitute, not any inherent barriers to reconstituting function.
Well, the other thing, and maybe you could comment on this evolution, and it's wonderful that it's occurring here, because I think people like you are really carrying the ball forward to learn from it. But from the perspective of the microenvironment, or the environment that is a tumor instead of a collection of cancer cells, there's another, as you're building up from small and first principles, there's a group of people going the other direction saying, this is the cancer that I see, our pathologists, as you know, identifying components, removing them, doing really sort of observational kind of studies. What genes are they making? What do they look like? Can we tell which team they're on? Are they a stromal cell? Are they a particular kind of immune cell? And that's still yielding some interesting observations. The immune cells that are there often don't have the agenda you thought they had when they were there. When you look at what types of genes they're trying to use, what kind of components they're trying to use, and that's occurring at the same time you're trying to reconstitute and reconstruct. Is this wired together well enough to learn something?
So I think there's a tremendous opportunity to bring to build more synergy. We have such a productive cancer center because we have such different skill sets, strengths, and personalities represented. Cancer is the ultimate case of the five blind men and the elephant, right? That each person reaches out and they find what their expertise and expectations predispose them to find, and then what you need to do is bring different people together. So one thing that's been really exciting for us is that both with foundation efforts, such as the Commonwealth and the Breast Cancer Research Foundation and the JKT Foundation, and then also on the National Cancer Institute side, we've really benefited from this recognition that multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary science are how we're going to make big breakthroughs. And so on the foundation and federal side, we've received tremendous support to bring together people with really different expertise, right? So we have people in physics, biomedical engineering, chemical engineering, oncology, pathology, surgery, radiation oncology. And then you get people who are just bringing such different approaches to it that synthetically, we get a much deeper understanding of the problem and a much greater ability to move towards patient impact.
So I have a question that I'll ask even for your hunch. It always seemed when you isolated cancer cells away from their entire environment that they were sort of oddly young, that they could reproduce sort of forever. Normal cells don't appear to be able to do this as well. The HeLa cells from Henrietta Lacks outlived Henrietta Lacks, right? They're still growing somewhere. And yet cancers arrive and become more virulent as people age. So one question I have for you is, what is aging functionally, and how is whatever component is aging driving this neoplastic process, this cancer virulence? Are there stromal cells that are aging? Is it the immune system that's aging? Is it the infrastructure that they've laid down, the streets and sidewalks? In your mind, as a hunch, what do you think is aging that's driving this incredible association with cancer, particularly bad behaving cancer and age?
So I think the most important word for being able to explain this is and, right? So it's not going to be this or that. So the more cell divisions you have, the more opportunities you have for a catastrophic error. So simply by being older, right, you've had more cell divisions in your body and a greater chance for cell intrinsic, you know, the cell itself to go wrong. With time, there's also more opportunity for environmental exposures. Things like asbestos are a classic example. Alcohol is a classic example, where it can cause problems over time. And it can also create an environment. If we think specifically in the case of hepatocellular carcinoma and alcohol, it can create a cirrhotic liver, which does serve as a precondition to cancer formation. And the third aspect is, I really do think there's this idea running around for more than 100 years of the field effect in cancer, that you can have an environment which is poised, independent of any specific exposure, that this patient's liver was poised, this patient's lungs were poised, and you can end up with multifocal cancer in there. You can get more than one spot. It's very clearly demonstrable in animal models. So I think that there's, and that's going to have to be in part about the extracellular matrix and the stromal cells. So if we think time means more cell divisions, greater opportunity for genetic errors. Time means greater chance for the person's lifestyle and environmental exposures to bring risk. And time also brings the opportunities for the environment, the microenvironment around the cancer cell to change.
I guess what I was driving a little bit was, there's this phenomenon in individual cells that don't reproduce forever when placed into cell culture that people have called senescence. It's, they stop replicating. They don't die off. They hang out a little bit, they change their agenda somewhat, often communicating with their environment in different ways. And as you get older, presumably many of the components will begin to develop sort of senescence features. But does the entire microenvironment senesce in some way? Is that why?
Well, if the entire microenvironment senesced, it would be really strange to think about cancers popping up in old age. So I see where you're going with this now. I used to have very exciting conversations with my postdoc advisor, Zena Werb, on this topic, now that I get it.
One of the great ones, that's right.
She is fantastic. And so what we would debate is, what's the ground state for a cell, right? So we think about an epithelial cell in a duct, right, in the mammary gland. It's not moving, right? It's not proliferating. It's not dying, right? And it's also not secreting milk most of the time. Mm-hmm. It's sort of in this kind of waiting state. And so what we would, people have, in fact, in part from these histology textbooks of fixed cells, which will never move again, this very static view of the normal cell, right? So the question is that the ground state for an epithelial cell to just sit there and do nothing? Or is that a very contrived state, right? It's working very hard. We're spending energy, right, in order to keep it in that state. Because what she would flip it around and say, well, the ground state for life, right? If you think about how do we define living versus non-living things, is movement, replication, all the things which are being repressed in that epithelial cell. So to speculate, one thing which can go wrong is if they're not supposed to move, they're never trying to move, yeah, sure, they should never move again. But if they spend their entire lives in essentially a state of frustrated movement, they want to move, they want to divide, but the controls are saying no, now a genetic event, a microenvironment environmental event, an exposure starts popping different controls off, they return to their ground state, which is movement and proliferation. So I think that gives you a sense
of
how...
almost imprisoned and liberated in a sense, yeah.
That's right. Well, that's actually an important... Again, I love the choice of language, because if you think on a longer time scale, think about evolution, right? We were once all, you know, back far enough, everything was single cell. The idea of a multicellular organism is very, very significantly about imprisoning all the cells in one boat and saying we sink or fall on the collective. You can't just bail out. Go and you know, you don't like how the body's going, just leave my elbow, crawl away and make a new Andy, right? And so they are imprisoned, they are being told. They are, major mechanisms are in place to maintain this lack of proliferation, lack of movement.
Another scientific question for you, and I ask you these kinds of questions all the time because I'm a great consumer of cell biology, as you know. Almost 40 years ago, I had the privilege of studying these curious things inside cells that provide some of their structure called keratin. Some people call it cytokeratins. And I don't think I had any clue when I was done studying them. We enumerated them very effectively, but I don't think we had any real clue as to what they did. Is there any better idea what they do? You find different ones associated with different phenotypes at the leading edge of a cancer that's misbehaving.
Yep. So yeah, we actually got into... We got into our study of cytokeratins, in particular cytokeratin 14, very fortuitously through a medical oncology fellow in my lab, Kevin Chung, who's now an independent faculty member doing very well at the Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center. And so we were actually trying to understand, ask some very basic questions about how does a cancer cell invade? How does it escape local constraints? And he kept bringing me this really surprising result, which was that in these what are called luminal cancers, right, so ones that had a particular flavor of gene expression, he kept finding, which is actually defined by their keratin expression, he kept finding that the cells leading invasion were expressing basal keratins. And so, of course, you know, being a brilliant PI, I said, well, that must be wrong. Go back in the lab and, you know, check again. And I think it was literally 1,536 times later, he said, Andy, like, we got to figure out what this means now. It's just true, right? Again, that benefit of scale from these organoid systems. And so what we're finding is that different phenotypes of epithelial cells have different keratin expressions. That was known before. It was known when you were working on
this. That's what we worked on, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
But what we're finding is that during metastasis, there's different... You want to think of metastasis very much as being a decathlon, right, and not a sprint. It's not just about running fast. It's about having to do a whole series of different tasks. And the final result, just as you say this person wins the decathlon, is the sum across all those events. So what it appears, based on our assays, modeling each of these steps of metastasis, is that different cell states favoring proliferation versus migration are better at accomplishing different tasks. And so the cell, during spread, actually puts on different sets of equipment to accommodate each of these different steps. And cytokeratins are a critical part of that toolkit. I came up with a fun analogy for an event in Boston, which is if you think of, think back to James Bond, right? And he had this challenge of getting underwater, right, over to an island where a particular event was occurring. So what does he do? He puts on scuba gear, right? He kicks across, climbs up out of there. Now he needs to evade security at an event at a fancy hotel, right? So what does he do? He unzips the scuba gear, takes it off, and there's a white tuxedo underneath, right? Now he's able to walk in and blend in the crowd. So what we're really excited about is this concept that different steps require different skills, require different molecular equipment for the cancer cell. That means by taking cancer cells out of a patient and putting them in these different assays, modeling the different steps, we can spy on them at the molecular level, figure out what equipment they're putting on, and identify therapeutic weaknesses.
So much like the decathlon, you can see that they're a great sprinter, but they can't make the mile or something
right,
like that. That's their vulnerability, and that might be how we attack them.
Yeah, so let's, you know, let's do some things to their running shoes, or if they have to pole vault, right, let's take away the pole, and they're not going to get as high, right? So I think the key is to understand what do they need to get the job done, and how do we take that away from them?
So this has been Bill Nelson talking with Andy Ewald. We've been dancing around the forefront of where physics, optics, microscopy, 3D cultures of cancer cells, and cancer biology really building the future of how we're going to better figure out how cancer cells misbehave and figure out how to stop them from doing so. And with that, I'd like to thank you, Andy, for being with us today. And for all of you listening, we are now on iTunes. You can get us for free. You can't get everything on iTunes for free, but you can get us for free if you search for the Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center. So look for us on iTunes, and thank you for being with us this afternoon.